Norman Solomon is a journalist, media critic, anti-war activist, and former congressional candidate. He was elected as a pledged Bernie Sanders delegate in the 2018 Democratic National Convention. Norman has just returned back from New York, where he's been having meetings and interviews on current aspects of what Martin Luther King called the madness of militarism, a relevant subject currently given Trump's attack on Syria the other day. We don't know where that's going to end. He's a longtime resident of Inverness Park and will share his expertise on what's happening in Washington, D.C. and the possibility of impeachment and the 2018 midterm elections.
Well, as being said, this group coalesced in the aftermath of the traumatic, for us, not for him, election of Donald Trump. I'm not going to go there in terms of his internals. But it's an obvious crisis that is ongoing. And I think it's so important that people in West Marin have found ways to work together in the form of this group and all the different committees. I often think of something that a Chinese strategist said long ago. When you're faced with an adversary, don't do what you most want to do. Do what your adversary at least wants you to do. And I think that's a real challenge for us. I think it was another great political analyst, John Stewart, who said that while we were making fun of Republicans as they went farther and farther over the edge, as we were learning to do what gave us satisfaction and strengthened us internally and enjoying the wonders of the world, whether it's playing guitar or any number of other things that we treasure, the right wing was running for school board. They were running for county commission and the zoning commission and the state legislature. And so Trump is a cause of great suffering and distress and ominous clouds coming closer and closer from the horizon to us and actually now over our heads. But he's also a symptom. He's a symptom of a culture, of a political economy, of a way in which corporate power is dominated, in which the environment is being savagely destroyed. And he's a symptom of our relationship to the political process. I think it's understandable that we may have felt, maybe still do feel to some degree, some ambivalence about the concept of power. After all, we've experienced power overwhelmingly as something that comes from above, that's non-democratic or perhaps even anti-democratic, that is imposed by corporate power that's unelected, by government that's intertwined with corporate power. And so our negativity towards power perhaps has led us to feel that we want nothing to do with power. And that is exactly what those who have gained so much leverage and control over the U.S. government want us to feel. In terms of what our relationship or view of power ought to be. After all, what do they least want us to do? They want us to contend for power. They want us to find ways to block their control over the major institutions of our society, particularly in terms of government. And so I think it calls upon us, not only abstractly or theoretically, but very concretely, what is our relationship to power? What's our attitude towards power? And is there something else that used to be called the power of the people, the spirit of people and humanity that can be brought to bear in a very positive way? So that power is something that we redefine, we reframe, we infuse it with a humanistic determination that the planet and human beings and life on this earth will be protected and, if you will, fought for. And if fight isn't the right verb, we think of something else. You know, we're going to defend, as the water protectors did, in terms of the Dakota pipeline, that we are on defense. And that is necessary because there's so much that life is worth defending. You know, the great analyst, when she wrote a book about war, Barbara Ehrenreich, said that people are willing to die for war? How many of us are willing to take such risks for peace? And this is in front of us every single day. When I think of various ideologies and constructs and analysis of what power is, one of the great theorists, perhaps even greater than John Maynard Keynes or Thomas Jefferson or Karl Marx, or you pick, is Lewis Carroll in Through the Looking Glass, where Humpty Dumpty is talking to Alice, and Alice, perhaps a bit perplexed, says, "But how can you make one word mean so many different things?" The question is, how can you do that? And the response from Humpty Dumpty was, the question is, who is to be master? That is all. And so for those who've grabbed control of the executive branch or the legislative branch, who are now infusing the Supreme Court with the latest nominee, now justice, it is about they are determined to be master. And our avoidance of conflict is most what they want us to do. They want us to confine ourselves to the internal growth, to the enjoyment, to the celebration of life. And ironically, by confining ourselves to the celebration of rights, of life, we are unwittingly participants in the destruction of life on this planet. So when it comes to how we're going to turn this around, we have an emulation of how it's been done in negative terms, in positive terms, and that is to fight for power, to fight for political power, to, at every level of government, as well as throughout civil society, to say that we have a, not only a right, a possibility, but a duty to ourselves, to our loved ones, to those we love who we've never met, and to future generations. This is absolutely essential. I think of Antonio Gramsci in prison under Mussolini, and he wrote of the necessity of pessimism of the mind and optimism of the will. And anyone looking at where we are now under Trump, if we don't fool ourselves, we have reasons for pessimism of the mind, or variously translated from the Italian, pessimism of the intellect. But what's the other part of that? It's the optimism of the will that's galvanized through action. Electoral, non-electoral, social movements. You know, often politicians think of their election campaigns as so profoundly important that social movements should be a subset of the election campaigns. It is, must be the opposite. That election campaigns are very important, and they are subsets of social movements, because all the great changes in our society that we have to be proud of, whether it's abolition, the women's rights to vote, civil rights, environmental protection, gay rights, we could go on and on, Social Security, Medicare, because people organized and it seemed impossible, and they made it possible. We're all familiar with the cliche, politics is the art of the possible. No, it's the art of the imperative. If we look at what is at stake now, the very survival of the planet. Now, this might seem far removed from local elections. I think it is not. Because so much is at stake, the ripple effects, the domino effects in 2020, the state legislature will, as in other states, be involved with reapportionment after the 2020 census. There are many, many issues that affect people we know or people we care about if we don't know, who are affected by the legislative actions of local, regional, statewide government. That's why at the front table, and if you haven't gotten it, please pick it up on your way out, I made a copy of this article from the IJ about Marin representative sidestep vote on farm worker overtime. We were represented by people who tried to prevent giving a modicum of decency to farm workers. And so we have a sort of a conceit, and we all fall into it. Oh, we live in Marin County. We live in the Bay Area. We live in North Bay. We're in West Marin. So we got it covered with the problems in North Carolina, the problems in North Dakota. Yes, the problems there and the problems here. How could we be represented by people who would see to it, if they had their will, through their votes, through their actions, that farm worker children 2, 4, 6, 8 years from now will go to bed hungry because they try to block the basic decency of overtime pay to farm workers in our communities and around the state. So our own willingness to disturb ourselves and see, no, the problem is not only out there, the problem is here. It becomes very concrete. You know, we enjoy when we hear piano being played or whatever, or, you know, music. We enjoy life, but this is part of our challenge. And so concretely, 2018, another legislative election, of course, coming up, federally midterm here, will determine who goes into the legislature. We tend to think of R versus D, Republicans versus Democrats. Well, particularly in these districts, it's often, if there is going to be, there will be a primary challenge. So when we have Mark Levine running for re-election, vote against farm worker rights, most fundamentally, we may learn by June whether an elected official in this area who's got a progressive background is going to be willing to do a primary challenge to Assemblyman Levine. Then it will fall to the standing together group here. Do we want to get involved? You know, in what way? Let me go a little bit farther from home ground, but not very far. To me, perhaps the most exciting race on the horizon, exciting race is plural, is in Richmond, California. You know, some of us have gone. I really admire those who risk so much from our area to go to North Dakota. All we got to do is go across the Richmond Bridge. All we've got to go is to Richmond. And there's a sheet here with background on the Richmond Progressive Alliance, one of the most important electoral and social movement coalitions in this country and among the most successful. Don't read about it much. Here is a benighted, suffering community, victims of environmental degradation and racism. On one day, through the release from Chevron, from the Chevron refinery, 15,000 people rushing to the emergency room. Can we imagine? If that had happened in Marin County, it would have been a national uproar. All these affluent people sent to, affluent white people sent to the emergency room. Happened in Richmond. That's the way it goes. That's a baseline that as people who care about the future in humanistic terms, we can never accept. And we have an opportunity. You know, I've talked with folks at the Richmond Progressive Alliance, which is the umbrella organizing group that's had such enormous success in Richmond. They're desperate for help. Richmond, several years ago, spent $3 million. Chevron spent $3 million in Richmond to defeat the progressive candidates and lost. And last year, the Chevron Corporation tried another tactic. They greenwashed their money through other candidates. Again, Chevron lost, the Progressive Coalition won. The progressives now have a 5-2 supermajority on the Richmond City Council, virtually unprecedented, a city of 100,000. So every issue that we might think about, corporate power, racism, environmental protection, basic democracy, whether we're going to turn around this huge carbon, political, oligarchical footprint stomping on our future. It's right there across the bridge into Richmond. And they're going to need our help. And on a couple of specific grounds, they're going to need our help. Because Chevron is gearing up to come at these candidates again for the Richmond City Council in 2018. And they're going to try to take them out. They're going to try to put in some sort of Chevron-friendly candidates. And what's at stake? The Chevron is extremely profitable through the refinery, one of the biggest in the country there in Richmond. And they have an opportunity now, they hope, at the top echelons of the Chevron headquarters to turn this around. They're very eager to do that. And so we have this opportunity to, in common cause with solidarity, work with folks. How could we do that? Well, we could go over and help canvas. We could do phone banks. We could invite people, and this might be the first step, people from the Richmond City Council, who are part of the Richmond Progressive Alliance, they're eager to come out here and talk with people. If you'd want to invite them to talk to a meeting or a special forum at the Dance Palace, how can we be helpful, not only about raising money, but about gaining awareness throughout this county and beyond in terms of what's really at stake? So I do encourage you to take this sheet with you, something I wrote up about the Richmond Progressive Alliance and the battle going on there. And a little birdie told me, I'm not at liberty to give you the name, but one of the people who has been a central leader of the Richmond Progressive Alliance is going to be running for the State Assembly next year. So it's another layer, not only the Richmond City Council, But to get someone in Sacramento who's not going to just check the box, which is the usual Democratic Party thing in Sacramento, and I know from being on the State Central Committee and going to conventions for years of the State Democratic Party, everybody's progressive as a Democrat. All you got to do is listen to them, even while sometimes they're doing the bidding of the pharmaceutical companies and big corporate entities. They're all progressive in name. But that doesn't solve the problem, obviously. So we have an opportunity, a dual opportunity, I think, in terms of Richmond, the city council, and this assembly race. And certainly, I'd be glad to convey any invitation you have for this candidate who's about to announce soon. Let me say something else about the Democratic Party leadership. You know, Bernie said recently that the National Party is still in control of those who are, with the rest of us, on the Titanic, but they don't seem to mind because they've got a first-class cabin. And this is a challenge that we continue to face because it's at all different levels and it's nothing personal at all. When Bill Dodd runs against Yuriko Yamada for a state Senate district race up there, and Bill Dodd's a former Republican who is a rabid anti-environmentalist, and Yuriko Yamada has a long track record when she was in the assembly of fighting for the environment, for poor people, fighting against racism, fighting against corporate power. And Jared Huffman endorses Bill Dodd, endorses the anti-democratic candidate. This is not a personal sort of issue. It's the way that politics so often runs, even at the upper levels, and sometimes especially at the upper levels of the Democratic Party. So we have this opportunity to redefine what politics is from the grassroots. And I think that in the case of these local races that we know are going to come up again in terms of Richmond and elsewhere, this is the opportunity. You know, the cliche is sort of true. All politics is local, but we add on to it, the ramifications are national and international, as we're seeing now in terms of war. You know, the Democratic Party is split at the very high levels. The missiles fly, and Nancy Pelosi says, I think it's a proportionate response. You know, the U.S. government under Obama, under Trump, abetting the massive slaughter from Saudi Arabia, actively abetting and participating in Yemen, thousands of people being killed on our dime. And, it's like Noam Chomsky said long ago, well, if you're against torture, probably first step is not to pay for it. If you're against people being slaughtered, the first thing is to not have the U.S. government actively participating, aiding, and abetting it. And those of us who worked, many I know in this room, worked against the invasion of Iraq before it happened. When I was in Iraq before the invasion, it was a police state. Nobody's going to say Saddam was anything other than a monster. But we look at that and we say, what catastrophe has been brought by the U.S.-led invasion. And now again, the siren song, we must invade, the humanitarian militarism. And it's all of a piece because I think grassroots politics and at the base, we have this opportunity to organize and see the issues as not just a laundry list, but connected. Because as being said, Dr. King talked about the madness of militarism. If you look at his wonderful speech that he gave on April 4th, 1967, Side Church, it is so powerfully relevant today, 50 years and a few days later, beyond Vietnam, called a time of choice, a time to choose. Very briefly, because I think I'm almost out of time here, look at the national picture. It is pessimism in the mind. You know? There's not a lot good. You know, the crazy corporate predatory so-called healthcare plan, yes, was beat back, so Obamacare was preserved, you know, at least for now. But the reality is that Gorsuch is, getting his robe fitted, and it's very dire. And I think this is going to be a building process. To take a grotesque example, Barry Goldwater was roundly defeated in 1964, and 4 years later, Richard Nixon was elected. So this can turn around, and I think a lot of our mission is to mitigate the damage and build political power from the base, and I think what is happening here in West Marin is really part of that process. In terms of the special elections in Georgia and elsewhere, I think I'd refer you to Liza because that work is important. And at the same time, as we can see on so many issues, if we rely on the leadership of the Democratic Party, we are sunk. When the people lead, the leaders will follow. That has been shown time and time again. And if the grassroots don't lead, then we have a historical landscape littered with tragedy that could have been avoided. So with that, I'll pause, and I think we have a scheduled time for some questions. Yes, Dale.
Impeachment.
Oh, good. Thanks for reminding me. I totally spaced that out. Well, a couple of weeks ago, we had a rally in Berkeley on that very topic. And rootsaction.org, and I hope all of you will sign up to rootsaction.org. Take you about 30 seconds to a minute. You go to rootsaction.org. You'll get action alerts. Today, we sent out one about Syria in terms of messaging it, so that within a minute, you can message your senators and rep. Anybody can do this. It's all zip-coded. Cut off funding for U.S. war-making in Syria. We do many action alerts. So I hope you will sign up at rootsaction.org. At Roots Action, we've co-sponsored the launch with an organization, Free Speech for People, of Impeach Donald Trump Now. We now have 925,000 signers around the country. So we have a very good email list to organize upon. And so if you haven't signed up yet, again, impeachdonaldtrumpnow.org. And the basic groundwork for the entire impeachment campaign is the emoluments clauses of the Constitution. And in a nutshell, there's a foreign clause and a domestic clause that, in real people's language, unlike the legal language, you don't get to have a president who rips off the government while getting rich or richer. And people said, hey, so soon, let's wait. The minority leader of the House, the Democratic leader, Pelosi, said, well, if he does something illegal, we'll move forward with impeachment. He did something illegal the first moment he took his hand off the Bible and became president, because very clearly the Emoluments Clause say that you don't get to profit from your position as president of the United States. And in the case of the domestic Emoluments Clause, it specifically names the president, and it can't be waived by Congress. So there is an impeachment campaign that's ongoing. It's going to be really a challenge, obviously, to pull it off, because in the House, for instance, you would need about 26 Republicans to flip and vote for impeachment, and that's tough, right? On the other hand, tough but not impossible, like so many things that we want to do. Let's remember, 1974, the House Judiciary Committee voted out articles of impeachment on Richard Nixon. 7 Republicans voted for impeachment. They didn't do it out of the goodness of their heart, but because people in their home districts and around the country were raising hell, and that's what we got to do. Yeah?
Tracking along with that, so when you think about impeaching Trump, I mean, that obviously sounds excellent, just because I certainly think not only nationally, but our international credibility, people are kind of really looking at us and really very concerned about who we are. But then when you think about if for some reason it's successful, look who's still in line.
Yeah.
So, I mean, they're almost scarier in a way to me, because, you know, they speak and act a little more, quote unquote, reasonably. So, I mean, how are you working with that within the whole impeach movement? I mean, I completely agree, but Pence and Ryan and McDonnell, I mean, they scare me. The McConnell, excuse me.
Yes, that's the most...
they're all terrifying as well.
It's the most frequently raised point about impeachment. It sort of reminds me, in a different context, what Daniel Ellsberg said when he was discussing the option, and this was many years ago, of the U.S. ending its military intervention in Afghanistan. And he said, pulling out of Afghanistan is a terrible scenario, and all the other options are worse.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And sometimes, unconsciously, we compare, well, what would happen if X takes place with some sort of vague, decent alternative. We don't get that. We don't get that choice. The next 4 years are going to be really, really bad. Well, we would like to make them just really bad instead of really, really, really bad. That's sort of part of our role, and lay the groundwork for a more affirmative step. But more concretely, The fact is not only that 26 or so Republicans would need to vote for it in the House, but because there's a two-thirds requirement for conviction in the Senate before Trump would actually be kicked out of the White House, that means I think it was 19 Republican senators would need to vote for impeachment. Can you imagine what that would do to the Republican Party? It would put them way back on their heels, the way that the Republican Party had massive losses in 1974 midterms, right after Nixon was out of office. So watching this come down with Trump, and I think he shredded any illusions that people had that there was any sort of positive, you know, he was some kind of moderate Republican, which has become sort of, you know, a oxymoron, kind of like, what was it George Carlin said, you know, jumbo shrimp and military intelligence, you know, sort of oxymoronic. There's no moderate Republican to be found hardly anywhere, certainly not Trump. So it's not a good scenario to keep it the way it is. Yeah. Any other questions? I don't know if we're just about out of time. Yes?
I'm surprised you didn't bring up Syria, you know, the bombing of Syria without consulting Congress. Mm-hmm. Seems like...
Yeah, well, since you asked, and thank you, you know, many groups that were, this is just a historical note, it doesn't have to do with where we are now, but many groups that were silent for 8 years while the previous administration was bombing in Afghanistan, bombing in Iraq, bombing in Syria, for that matter, under Obama, they've come alive, now they're anti-war, you know, and I'll take it. You know, but what we need is a single standard of human rights, a single standard against that madness that King spoke about in terms of militarism. I think it's a horrific action by Trump. You'll see the Democratic Party leadership is split. Senator Chris Murphy from Connecticut put out a very good statement. Bernie's put out a statement. But on the whole, there's sort of a squishiness. Well, maybe it's a good thing, you know. So from my vantage point, I think it's very important to oppose this. It's very dangerous. Some of the stage has been set with the idea that Trump is a flunky, a tool of Moscow, which is a great incentive for him to prove that he's not. And here we've got 4,000 nuclear weapons essentially pointed at us from Russia. They've got essentially in Russia 4,000 nuclear weapons pointed at them from the United States. And we're being encouraged, and frankly, you know, this is Rachel Maddow, this is MSNBC, this is the Democratic Party line. Russia's supposed to be the enemy. Excuse me, but if Russia's supposed to be the enemy, and we are the nuclear powers of the world, with 90% of the nuclear weapons between these two countries, what is our future? You know, what kind of future are we going to have when we keep beating the drum to escalate conflicts between these two countries? It is a tripwire danger in Syria. In response, the Russians have suspended this cooperative relationship to try to have both countries know what planes are in the air doing what. It's a kind of a madness. It really is a madness. And the propaganda that we've been getting that somehow the problem with our democracy is Russia. Is it Russia that kept black people from voting last year? Is it Russia that kicked hundreds of thousands of people of color off the rolls in Ohio, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin that turned the election? These are self-inflicted wounds. The problem with our democracy, the problems, plural, are overwhelmingly from within our country, the corporate power, the racism, the way in which we have continued to face this oligarchical system. So that's a long-winded answer to your very good question.
Maybe one more.
Oh, okay, one more, and then I'd be glad to talk with people afterwards. Yes?
After that geographic explanation, I want to do something very local. I just didn't know anything about your comment about Huffman and his endorsement of Dobb. Mm-hmm. And whether we should take action to keep his feet to the fire. Yeah. Can you talk about that? Yeah.
Well, it's unfortunately, in this one specific case, the horse is out of the barn. Bill Dodd won, you know, so he's in the state Senate. But these other things come up. And I think it goes to the similar question, in a way, the farm worker overtime vote, because wasn't just, for that matter, Mark Levine. It was... McGuire too, Mike McGuire, did not support farm worker rights. And it's sort of, it's emblematic of a lot of issues. So I think it means us, and perhaps could be part of the midterm elections committee, to research in detail sort of at a granular level and never, never, never hitch ourselves to the wagon of any politician, any elected official. We may love them, they may do wonderful things, but when we sign that over, then we're reducing and sometimes eliminating the power of the people, so to speak, ourselves. And I'd sort of close by quoting the great journalist I.F. Stone. He said, "All governments lie, and nothing they say should be believed." He wasn't saying that every government lies all the time, but it was saying that to give over that faith, whether to an individual elected official or anyone else, or to a government, is a recipe for disaster. And we have so many examples of that on the national level. Words like Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia, Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, on and on. The list is way too long, and we obviously want to prevent it from getting any longer. Thanks to all of you for inviting me.